anticipated being. So I don't know. At least we have the leisure. And then from 12 o'clock or whenever this session ends, 12 o'clock or before, until 1:30, there's a lunch break. As I explained, there are restaurants to the east of us here up University Parkway. And there's a Taco Bell and a Subway, I think, on campus somewhere here. But there's time to go somewhere and get something to eat. And then at 1:30 we'll reconvene, but I'll have something to say about that at the end. Our first presenter is Jim Faulkner of the Department of Philosophy at Brigham Young University. You see the title on the screen, Dualism is Dead, Long Live Dualism. That should be fun. Jim wanted me to correct. Some of you have seen the program. We had a limited number of them. There he's identified as Richard L. Evans Professor of Philosophy at BYU. That's wrong on two counts. He is no longer the Richard L. Evans professor. He's relinquished that to a new occupant of that chair. And it never was the Richard L. Evans chair of philosophy. It was the Richard L. Evans chair of religious understanding, originally Christian understanding, then eventually more broadly a religious understanding. So we're 0-2 on that. But he is a professor at BYU, so we didn't strike out altogether. And so I'll turn the time over to Jim and the mic.
So is that working? Yeah, sounds like this. I want to start by thanking Dan for remembering Stephen, and for all of us who knew Stephen, this is a huge tragedy, and makes it difficult to do this in some ways because he was to be an important part of this conference. I also want to thank Brother Guy for introducing my presentation. I've seldom had someone give such a long introduction to what I was going to say. I don't have his style. I don't have Stephen's eloquence. But what I'm going to do, I hope you'll see, follows up with the kinds of things that Brother Guy was saying about science and philosophy and art and religion and a lot of other things. Not very many contemporary philosophers take dualism, traditional dualism, seriously. I think I'm beating against my coat or something. Let me move this a bit so I don't constantly have that noise in the background. Maybe that will work better. It's become impossible to defend the kind of dualism that this kind of separation of body and mind that descends from Descartes. But on the other hand, there's a huge amount of folk psychology and folk talk about these kinds of things that still continues with us. If you ask many people what they mean by body or mind or spirit or soul, they very often will end up invoking some kind of Cartesian language. And they're unaware of the origins of it, they're often unaware of the implications of it, but they use that language anyway. It's unaware, they're unaware of it, but there it is. Among scientists, in the wake of dualism's failure, it's become common to assume that the alternative to traditional dualism is a thoroughgoing monistic materialism in which mind can be sufficiently explained by the interactions of some sort of physical structure and chemistry. But these explanations make it difficult for us to think about such important things as agency, value, the human experience of self. And without robbing them of their human significance, they turn into nothing more than the movement of atoms. And surely my choice to come here today, rather than to be with my visiting granddaughter, it was more than the movement of atoms. We seem, therefore, to be on the horns of a dilemma. On the one hand, we need the language of dualism to talk about religious experiences, it seems, but that language no longer works, if you think about it carefully enough. But the alternative seems to reduce human beings and human values to little more than the motions, interactions of electrophysical particles. So what I want to try to do today is to begin by reviewing that dualism that has failed, giving you a kind of history of it. Where did it come from? What does it mean? And it's how it's connected to religious belief. And then I want to outline an alternative to dualism that allows for serious consideration of both body and mind without reducing one to the other and without postulating any Cartesian essences. My position will be one in which there are no ghosts in the machine, but there is more than one possible and equally cogent explanation of body and mind and their interrelationship. I believe the position I will point to is compatible with a scientific investigation of human behavior, including brain research, but also compatible with LDS and other religious belief about bodies, spirits, and souls. But I have to say, I hesitate to say how it is compatible. I don't think I mean, I can think I can say, point in the direction of compatibility. I'm not really ready to, I'm not even qualified to say what that compatibility would look like. Before I start, though, and this is part of what I'm doing right now, I want to add that the philosophy of mind is not my specialty. Even a cursory reading of the Stanford Encyclopedia entry on dualism and a comparison of what I say here will reveal that what I say is naive. I approach this as a Latter-day Saint, religious professor of philosophy who has thought about this question in broad terms for a long time, but who's not delved into the particularities of the issues in the way a real philosopher of mind would and should. I'm an amateur, but perhaps that will give me the advantage of being able to speak more easily to others who are like me and who are curious about the question and interested in thinking about it. On the other hand, perhaps what it will really do is just prove, yet again, that naivete is not always a virtue. Now, probably many of you, many who think about the question of body and soul, believe that the classical dualism begins with Judaism or Christianity and their teachings. And there is truth in that belief, but things, as always, are more complicated than it might first appear. At first glance, the fact that those religions, our religions, can speak of two things suggests that they take the body and the spirit, or the soul, to be separate, interacting entities in the way that Descartes postulates. But some reflection brings that into question. The first thing to notice is that the Hebrew Bible uses three terms for human beings rather than two. One is basar, for the human body, quite often translated by the word flesh. You see that in paired couplets like basar and bones, in other words, flesh and bones. And that, I think, makes the meaning clear. It's this stuff that we have here, this embodied stuff. The fact that, in addition to it, though, the second term is nefesh, which appears originally to have meant breath, but in the Bible usually seems to mean something like, when we translate it, soul, and which refers to the person as a whole, not just a spirit, not just something in me, but my living person. And can also be translated in terms of words like desire, right? Hunger, sexual desire, and so on. And the third term is used for a human person is ruach. Like nefesh, the earliest meanings of that term are something like to breathe. And since in this case it's the air in motion that we have, you know, that seems to be what is in, the term has in mind. And so the word is often translated as things like breath, wind, or spirit. But even though there are three Hebrew terms, and we have three terms, body, mind, and spirit, it is not obvious how to map our translation onto those three terms. They're certainly not equivalent one for one. We have to ask this question. Do these terms refer to two things? So body on the one hand and spirit / soul on the other, right? Or do they refer to three different things? Now, very often, most people have read it as referring to two things, answering the first question, yes. But there are others in the tradition who have read it as postulating the existence of three things, body, spirit as one thing and soul as another thing. And on this second tripartite view, the body can be understood as what Aristotle called material cause, the stuff of which something is made. And the spirit, for these people, is thought of as the formal cause, the idea of the thing, the form in the broad sense, not just the physical form, but the form as, for example, being rational. And then finally, the soul is the final cause or the purpose, that reason for which this thing exists, its relationship to the good. Perhaps a case can be made for that latter translation of three things. I have to say I'm skeptical about it. But the fact is that the multiplicity of biblical or other scriptural terms for body, soul, spirit, mind, and so on doesn't by itself tell us how we should understand those terms. It doesn't give us a metaphysical position. We infer a metaphysical position when we read the scriptures and we translate them into our particular ways of seeing the world, but the scriptures don't answer that question. Now, some of us might instead, we might think that this refers to properties of entities. We have to be careful, though, about interpreting these biblical language and metaphysical terms because, as the thinker Yoram HaZoni has said, we assume the Bible is making metaphysical claims, at least implicitly, but what if it isn't? What if that's not what's going on there? Then what are we doing when we import those metaphysical terms to our readings of Scripture? I think that's the more important difficulty with trying to think in these terms. We assume the Bible is making metaphysical claims. If it's not, then what? There are multiple reasons, in fact, to believe that our theological reflections on what the Bible and other scripture says about body and spirit or soul have perhaps been eisegesis, reading into the text, rather than exegesis, reading out of the text. Whatever the case with our theological interpretations of scripture, the writers of the Bible do not seem to be thinking of different things, beings connected to one another in the same person in some mysterious way. Think about Genesis 2:7. The Lord formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. This does not say that God placed an Adam soul or Adam spirit into a separate and distinct Adam body. Instead of that, it says that he created a body and he brought life to that body. Receiving breath, man became a living soul. He wasn't a soul until he received God's breath. Now, there is latter-day scripture that might be relevant to thinking about this issue, Doctrine and Covenants 88:15, which tells us that the term soul means the spirit and the body. And that may solve this apparent contradiction, apparent problem, not a contradiction. Perhaps one could say God created a body, but that body was not a soul until he put a spirit into it, assuming that breathed into his nostrils the breath of life is metaphorical for putting Adam's spirit into the material body. That's a possible reading. But for reasons tangential to my discussion here, I don't think that really resolves the problem of how to read Genesis 2:7. Even if it does, however, it's sufficient to say that there is no single theological anthropology in the Bible. In fact, I think it's safe to say that there is no single theological anthropology, no way to understand human nature in the Bible. We are left to interpret for ourselves how to understand body and spirit or soul if we wish to do theology. And most of us, and I'm a person who's often argued for why theology is a dangerous thing, but I do it all the time, and you do it all the time, we all do it all the time. That is dangerous doesn't mean, eating cake is dangerous, and you can tell from what I look like that I do it all the time. So a dangerous thing isn't necessarily something that we must quit doing. We are made in the image of God, we're told, and that's scripturally clear. But what soul and spirit are, or more importantly, how they are related to the body, are not explained to us. So we don't have some single way to understand human nature. But suppose we do turn our reflective gaze on this question about how do body and soul and spirit relate to each other. Early Christian thinkers assumed that soul and spirit are the same thing. That's a common assumption in the first several centuries after Christ. The term mind, nous, means something else, however. It occurs in the Church Fathers, but it's uncommon in the New Testament. For those early Christians, then, the only question in this regard is how to think about the relation of the soul to the body. And Gregory of Nyssa from the 4th century believed that the soul came into being at birth with the first breath of the infant. But according to Gregory, the soul is not a separate entity not something put into the body. Rather, it's not like a hand in a glove or something like that. Instead, the soul is a power diffused throughout the body that makes the body a living thing. What does it mean to be alive? It means to have a soul. What does it mean to have a soul? It means to be alive. It's a power rather than an entity, a power diffused in my whole body. Gregory's theory, therefore, is not really dualistic. Even if we see how a dualism might descend from what he says, his own version is not a dualism. So about a half a century later, in the early late 4th century, Augustine, influenced by Plato, did offer perhaps the first truly dualist Christian notion of soul and body. But even when we say these things, we always have to be careful that we're not just assuming that what we mean when we say soul is the same thing that Augustine meant when he said soul, or that when we say body, we mean the same thing that he did. But let's, at least for the nonce, let's just give it to ourselves that Augustine, when he says that body and soul are different, he means what we mean. One of the things to notice about Augustine, if you read what he says about these things, is he's really not very sure about his theory of soul. And in fact, he isn't even interested in the theory as a theory. He's just trying to show that the Manichaeans are wrong about evil. And he's clear about some things in doing that, among them that the soul is immaterial. But he doesn't try to explain how that immaterial soul is related to the body. He considers several possible ways of understanding the soul and how it's related to the body. And in some of them, if you're a Mormon, someone, two of those cases, what's interesting is that he thinks the soul is preexistent. But that's two out of four. So, in the other two, he wasn't so sure. Nevertheless, in every one of his outlines of the theory of soul, it does exist as a separate immaterial entity. It is in the image of God, but it's not the same substance of God. It inhabits the physical body in some way, as the person might live in a home. That's the analogy that he gives. The soul inhabits the body. This is clearly a dualist theory, a material body inhabited by an immaterial soul. It's the origin of the kind of dualism that we have today, that we find about us when we think about mind and body naively. It's important to also remember, though, that in spite of Augustine's importance to subsequent Christian thought, the most important contributor to this issue, to this discussion, in fact, to almost every discussion during the medieval period, was Aquinas in the 13th century. And Aquinas was an anti-dualist. In thinking about the human soul, as in many other things, Aquinas followed Aristotle. He argued that the soul is the form of the body. In other words, it is its principle of life. It's what Aristotle called the body's actuality. It's that which makes the living body what it is. It makes it an actual living thing. This way of thinking about the soul begins at least in the early 6th century when Thales attributes soul to magnets. He says that magnets are animated. They have the power of animation. They move themselves, so they have soul. But Thales does not seem to mean that there are these physical magnets in which some ghost has entered. What he means instead is that there is the power of movement in the magnet. That's what it means to be this kind of material. It's merely to say that there is something about magnets that causes them to move. The soul of a magnet is that about it, whatever it is, property or entity, that makes it a magnet rather than just a lump of something else. Now, 200 years after Thales, Aristotle refined this theory of thinking about soul, this pre-Socratic theory of soul, and he applied it to everything, not only to animate objects. So he said everything has the form, everything has a form. In this... wood is the matter of which my office chair is made, and its function and its shape as a chair is its form. In the same way, the body is the flesh, is the matter of the person, and that aspect of its existence that makes it be a person rather than a dead body, for example, is the soul, its form. A person has the physical shape that she does and acts in the way that she does because she has the form of a human being. And this is the theory that Aquinas adopts from Aristotle. But Aquinas' thinking about the soul has a theological problem. And it's a problem that sets a stage for later dualistic theories. The problem is that given his explanation of the soul and its relationship with the body, it's difficult to explain how the soul can continue to exist after the death of the body. If the soul is that which makes the body a living thing and the body is a dead thing, then what's the soul? If the magnet disappears, so does the magnetic activity. If my chair is destroyed, so is the work that it does as a chair, so is its actuality. How then can the soul exist when a body is dead if it is the Aristotelian form of the body? That tension between Aquinas' anti-dualistic understanding of soul and his belief in the soul's immortality remained a difficulty for medieval theologians to wrestle with in a variety of ways, including that propounded by someone we've heard before today, William of Ockham in the 14th century. With Aquinas, previous thinkers had insisted that the thing is composed of form and matter, neither of which exists except in the thing. The thing is what gives the form and matter their reality. The only place to find the form of a person is in the actual person. It doesn't interexist as a separate minute. But Ockham changes this quite a bit. He agrees that a thing is made out of form and matter. He says, yeah, we have form and we have matter. But he argued that form and matter exist independently. The form of the person is not the same as the person, this individual we see before us, and the matter is not the same. The two come together as separate things in this new being. For him, the person is a sum of soul and body, which are separately existing entities. Now, I don't think anyone prior to Ockham had really made that case very clearly, if they'd made it at all. And that means that when religious people feel that the dualistic account of mind or soul and body is the best account that religious people have given, the best account of their religious belief, they're not relying on an ancient religious tradition, though I suppose there are those of you who think that the 14th century is ancient. If you're a philosopher, you don't. You think that's relatively recent. And if you're my age, you think it's relatively recent whether you're a philosopher or not. When we think in those dualistic terms that I've just described, what we're doing is thinking in Occam's terms. So, and I just noticed that I have 13th century for Ockham in my slide, and I apologize. That's what comes from making your slides this morning at about 8 o'clock. Now, the fact that they're relying on Ockham, of course, does not mean that people are wrong. Ockham could be the first person to get the theory of soul right. But it does mean, the fact that we rely on Ockham does mean that the connection between that theory and Scripture is less obvious than it might seem at first glance. It's a tenuous connection. I believe it shows that Hazzoni is right. When we understand the scriptural account in dualistic terms, what we're doing is relying on eisegesis, taking our theories and reading them into the scriptures, rather than on exegesis. The next culprit in this story is René Descartes, and I think I got his right on the slide, of the 17th century, that's right. Descartes develops a dualistic theory of body and soul with which we're most acquainted. And he takes it very much from the Occamist view. Dualism preceded him by several hundred years, but it did come from his religious tradition. But notice it did only precede him by a few hundred years, not by thousands. This is, again, a relatively recent notion. And Descartes changed the dualism that he inherited significantly. Now, he was the thinker who clearly equated mind and soul. And this is pretty much for the first time. Most previous people who thought about this issue had not said mind and soul are the same thing. For Descartes, they are. So that's the one thing he did. He also clearly divided the realms of body and soul, at least as much as Ockham, if not more, so much so that he raised the question of how is it possible for them to interact? Now, you have on the one hand this spatial and material thing that obeys natural law. You have this other thing that's spatial, non-spatial, and it is immaterial, and it doesn't obey natural law. So the question is, how does the mind ever get the body to do anything? How does that immaterial mind get my hand to raise itself? When this hand raises by mechanical natural law, and my brain works by mechanical natural law, and the mind, whatever it is, doesn't. How does that happen? Today, when most people think about dualism, they're thinking in these Cartesian terms. You're using Descartes' version of dualism. There are material bodies, including the brain, which operates by the laws of nature. There are immaterial entities, souls that have material bodies. And those entities have what we call free will. Now, free will is another of those things that clearly changes its meaning over time. For a long time, it just meant what we might call agency, the ability to choose, something that, of course, we want to believe in and argue for. But it comes to mean, because of this definition of mind and not obeying any natural law, and not obeying any law in some sense at all, it comes to mean an uncaused cause. The mind is what can cause events, but for which there is no real explanation of how it does it. It enters into the world, it makes things happen in the world, and that's all we can say. Now, the first problem with dualism that I want to consider is that this view means that I am not a physical thing. Descartes is very clear about that. I'm associated in some way with a physical body, but I am not a physical body. Why? Because I'm a thinking thing. I'm a mind. That's how Descartes defines the individual, the person. Then the mind is completely immaterial. So I am this immaterial thing. I exist something like a being in a matrix, like alternative universe, and I look out into the physical world from inside the body that I happen to occupy. Though since the mind is not spatial, it's not even clear what it means for it to be inside the body. Now, this view is largely behind many of the pathologies of contemporary culture that we sometimes come across. The kinds of things that happen when we instrumentalize our bodies. We think of them as just tools to be used either for something like fashion or for pleasure or whatever we happen to do. We make them the tools of our will in some instances and insist on our difference from our bodies and others. I am not, I might say, an overweight person. I am a person in an overweight body. That would be a lie. I'm an overweight person. I'm not separable from my body. As who I am, I'm a physical embodied being. Even if mind in the Cartesian sense existed, I would not be that mind. Another problem is how mind and body interact. Mind/soul-body interact. If one of these is material and the other is immaterial, as I mentioned, how can there be causal interaction between the two? Now, Descartes' answer is a very strange answer. They act through the pineal gland, a small bulbous gland sitting at the top of the brainstem. Why there? We don't know why he chose that gland. Perhaps when he looked at it, it appeared that it wasn't divided. It appeared to be one round entity. It turns out later on with a close microscopical investigation, it is divided like the rest of the brain. But he thought it wasn't. Maybe that's the answer. But in any case, he begs the question. How do the material and the material and the immaterial interact causally in that physical organ when they don't seem to be able to act causally anywhere else? So just giving it a location doesn't change the problem. A third problem with Cartesian dualism is that the notion of uncaused events is rationally incoherent. We can't really make sense of what it means to say this is an uncaused event. We experience the world in terms of cause and effect. If you ask me why I chose to come here today rather than to be with my granddaughter, I could give you reasons. I could explain it. I couldn't explain it to my daughter, but I could explain it to myself at least. Here I am. All right, so we experience the world in terms of cause and effect, in terms of these connections of events. Even if we don't know what caused an event, we cannot but assume that something did. The notion of uncaused events seems to have been invented for no other reason than to preserve the notion of free will. It seems to be something we want to assert to save our assumptions rather than to make sense itself. But surely we can defend the notion of human agency without needing to take recourse to mystery, to immaterial events, to uncaused causes. So Cartesian dualism continues to have defenders. I think it's safe to say, though, that most contemporary thinkers find it completely implausible as a theory of mind. It requires this belief in uncaused causes, in other words, in what has now come to be free will, which is not necessarily the same as agency. It requires belief in two realms of being that interact in some mysterious way. It requires that I deny that as a person I am embodied. And above and beyond those plausibilities, Cartesian dualism ultimately falls to the principle given to us by the same philosopher who gave us the soul, mind on the one hand and body distinction on the other, namely Occam. Occam's razor tells us that in general the hypothesis with the fewest assumptions is the right one. But we can explain everything in question without referring to the immaterial world that Descartes presupposes that he calls mind. So by Occam's razor, we don't need the theory that includes mind. We don't need dualism. Now, I've given you sort of the history and the way that the argument has gone, and there are lots of ways in which I agree with that. I certainly think that Descartes' theory of mind doesn't solve any of the problems we wanted to solve. We're making a mistake if we continue to defend the Cartesian view or some variation on it, trying to turn it into the scientific view. But many who reject the view nevertheless retain it in what might be called the formal sense. So what I'm arguing now is that even the monistic materialists who want everything to be done simply in terms of physics and chemistry or something like that, it turns out, I think, that they too are Cartesians. To see what I mean by that, think again about this Cartesian argument. So following Occam, the Cartesians postulate that the world consists of two things, right? The material world and the immaterial world. It says the material events and the relationships are explained by the mechanical laws of nature, but there's no explanation for immaterial events except will, which is a mystery. Notice that implicit in this postulate is the assumption that the two kinds of things and the two kinds of action, mechanical and uncaused, cover the territory of what needs to be explained and how to explain it. My argument is that the mistake of dualism lies in that assumption, as is also the mistake of those who criticize it. So I'm going to use a kind of cartoon version of the history of dualism to make my point. So if you start with Descartes' initial assumption, there are material and mechanical entities and immaterial entities, then you reject immaterial entities, all that remains are material entities explained by their mechanical relationships. That's where we start, and that's what the argument, I think, looks like historically. But the conclusion only follows if we grant that first premise. If we grant Descartes' original division of the world into the mechanical and the non-mechanical. And that way of rejecting Cartesian dualism continues to take the form of Cartesianism insofar as the universe of discourse is merely a truncated Cartesian universe. We have the same initial starting point, we just cut off a piece of it. And what's left is still the Cartesian world. Descartes is continuing to understand what is by understanding it in terms of the mechanical relations, and though his descendants do the same thing. Now, it might look like there's no immediate alternative to this, that the only thing there is to understand if we reject immaterialism are these mechanical relationships of material entities. But what if the world is thicker than my truncated Cartesianism assumes? What if there are additional ways of talking coherently about the world? What if the world is so thick, rich, dense, sumptuous, and fecund that it can be described accurately and even fully in multiple, sometimes overlapping, but not always overlapping, and seldom irreducible languages. I'm going to use that word language in a metaphorical sense here. Now, in such a case, if the world is that way, the language of mechanics, whether it's Newtonian or contemporary, would give a coherent, consistent, complete account of the world without exhausting what can meaningfully be said about it. So would careful, thoughtful accounts of human life in terms of agency. So there would be at least two languages we could use, one irreducible to the other. There would be more than one accurate, coherent way to talk about the world. These other ways of speaking would not necessarily overlap with the language of mechanics. It might, we don't know. These other languages would have standards of rigor and truth, though those standards might not be the same as the standards of physical science. I have to put a footnote here. I actually think that logic isn't just our creation. I think it is real. But I think it's only part of certain kinds of languages, only demanded by certain kinds of languages, and not all of them. So it's a very mild disagreement. Presumably, given this richness and fecundity of the world itself, there are in principle an infinite number of such languages. But that's only in principle. In practice, in fact, there are many such languages: poetry, science, religion, family relations, ordinary life, the way we talk to each other about food, the way we talk to each other about motor cars, art. All of these are examples of the kinds of languages we use in which there are coherent ways of talking about the world that are governed by rules, that have standards of rigor. But the number that we use in any given life is finite. And almost everyone, every normal adult human being masters quite a few of these languages. The existence of other coherent languages does not imply that the language of physical causation is incomplete or that it's wrong. It only follows that there is more than one way to talk accurately about the richness of the world. Many of them exist side by side, but not, you can't say that one of them is better than the other. Sometimes they're just simply incomparable. Every language has a universe of discourse. Every language has a purpose. The universe of discourse of the language of physical science is that of the physical world, of things as present at hand, taken out of any particular cultural practice or historical context, to be understood cross-culturally. Science is dealing with real things when it takes up that present at hand world, and the scientist who doesn't refer to human intentions when engaged in that project hasn't left something out. There's no reason, however, to suppose that the physical world is more real than other worlds we inhabit, such as the social world. Subatomic particles are real, but so are love and hate, community and loneliness. The world of physical things and that of our human relationships are two different worlds, to be sure. They overlap in places, sometimes quite a bit. But nevertheless, nothing except historical prejudices makes us believe that the language of physical science is the standard for all other language about the world that we inhabit, that we live in. Now, I can't reasonably speak of values and meaning without talking about intentions and choices. It would be a category mistake to try to do that. So that means there are at least two languages in which I can meaningfully speak of human acts. I can speak about the language, using the language of physical science, so that I talk about brains, I talk about neurons, chemical reactions, and so on. But I can also talk about human acts using the language of agency and meaning. These are just different ways of talking about the world, different ways of doing things in the world that we want to do. So neither is reducible to the other, so we end up with two. Each is equally about the world we live in. This is a dualism. So dualism as a metaphysical doctrine is, I think, philosophically incoherent. But there is dualism in spite of that. The irreducible dualism of our talk about the physical world and that of our talk about the human world. So on the view that I'm arguing for, two things are possible. It would be in principle possible to give a completely causal description of brain states and their relations as explanations of a particular event of human behavior. Yet it would also be possible, though in another kind of language, and importantly, in another kind of language, to speak of human meanings, intentions, purposes in relation to the same event. Now, the temptation is always going to be to ask, which of them is right? My answer is, it's possibly each. Long live dualism. The dualism of how we explain our human world. As you've noticed, of course, I'm not talking just about dualism. I'm also talking about a multiplicity of languages. Besides the languages of physical and social sciences, there are the languages of poetry, the language of scripture, which I take to be a very important language, which certainly ought not to be confused, as it far too often is, with the language of science, and vice versa. This idea that the scriptures are just primitive science is madness. It's just a kind of ignorance, probably certainly of religion, perhaps of science too. These other languages also tell us about the world we find ourselves in. As human beings, we speak multiple languages, And there is not one language that finally trumps all of the others. Not one language integrates all others. So there's this dualism of all our talk about physical world, the psychosocial world, and so on. But does this suggest that we're doomed to some kind of fragmentation, using whatever tools we need to get the job done, but never able to bring together those things into a whole? My answer is no, not as long as we can speak the multiple languages of the aspects and activities of our lives. The unity of languages that we speak in learning and knowing the truth is not the unity of a new language, it's the unity and integration of a person who speaks these languages. So the consequence is then that in the end, I'm willing to say, long live explanatory dualism, let's keep it going. Long live the multiplicity of ways of explaining without reducing one to the other, and particularly long live the unity of integrated lives. Thank you. As a neurologist practicing treating diseases of the brain, I've been intrigued by the concept summarized in Jeffrey Schwartz's Mind the Brain, that the mind is primitive reductive of the universe, being able to change the material brain, so-called neuroplasticity, via quantum mechanics. Any thoughts or comments?
No.
This is way beyond my sphere of expertise. I think it's a very interesting thesis or idea, but I have no trouble. If this turns out to be an interesting thesis, I have no trouble saying that. Great, but I don't know enough to say anything about it. As I said, you did ask a naive person to talk about this, so you get naive responses. I apologize. Can the relationship between the spirit and the physical body be in conflict because it's a relationship to the universe? Spirit desiring to coexist more closely to that from whence it came, and the physical being being a prison until the physical desires that which the spirit desires. I think there's no question that the spirit and the body not only can be in conflict, that's what it means to be in sin. Right? I don't want to make too much personal confession, but I certainly have experienced this conflict of spirit and body. Paul talks about this in chapter 8 of Romans, right? That which I would do, I don't. That which I wouldn't do, I do. I wish I were thin. That's an example I can use without too much embarrassment. I wish I were thin, but I'm not. Why? I eat too much. Why don't you eat less? I don't know. I want to eat less. I don't. I tried dieting. I cheat. So when it comes to food, I'm a sinner. I think there's no question that we have that. How is this overcome? I think it is a matter of a different kind of integration, but I do think it is a matter of discipline more than anything else. I learn how it is that my body and my spirit work together, not as two competing things, not an entity. I'm much more of an anti-dualist in metaphysically. But in terms of the language, I would say the language of science probably isn't going to help me think about this problem as much as the language of religion. And so that's where my answer ultimately is. If not for the grace of God, I will be the sinner. I would end up. I don't think there's another out. Certainly it's not willpower, which is the Cartesian answer. You just will it. That doesn't work for me. Since the spirit has been in existence for a long time, but the body has been only an organized entity for a short time, doesn't the spirit as a longer time, higher organization, understand the things of God better than the body, and thus the spirit is responsible to touch the body, teach the body the ways of God? There's so much assumption in the question about the nature of the spirit and the body. And these are questions that I don't know the answer to very well. But the question assumes that I do. So I'm having, there's a sense in which I want to say to this question, I understand the import of the question, and I agree that I should be listening to the Spirit of God, and I should be obedient to that and learn to discipline myself in that way. But I'm nervous about answering the question yes, only because, as I say, the way the question is put assumes some of the kind of dualisms about the body that I'm uncomfortable with and about the Spirit. I'm told to shut up. Then the chair said that was his job. So I shut up.
We've got some good questions here. You might want to take them with you. And
I don't know. Yeah.
But some people may come up to you afterwards.
Yeah, I'll be happy.
Let me... Oh, or you give that to me.
Yeah. No, I'll take it off.